Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Cutting the Curd is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country? For more information, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. It's my pleasure to have Tom Milan, author of the Meat Hook Meat Book, with me in the studio today. Welcome, Tom.
Great to be here.
Anyway, first, let me explain to the listeners why I'm including a meat book on Cutting the Curd, a cheese show. It's because I had the distinctive pleasure of meeting Tom Milan when we both worked behind the counter at Murray's Cheese Shop. In what year was it?
That would have been 2000...
Four or five?
Yeah, it was 2004.
Were you in the old store? Did you move to the new store?
Yeah, we were at the old store, and then we moved to the new moved everything over to the new store, and then...
So that was 04, November 04.
Yeah, and then I left, I think, in December. I didn't like the new space as much. I liked the old one.
The old, like, cozy space.
I don't know, and then, like, all the, like, you know, like Barbara, you know? It's like, you got my basket cheese.
Anyway, so we have crossed paths many times since, as Tom has made a transition from cheese to meat, from Marlowe and Sons and Diner to owning his own shop, The Meat Hook, which is a few blocks from my house in Williamsburg. So, wow, what a treat to read this book, Tom.
I'm glad you liked it.
Loved it. Loved the way it looks. Loved the way it sounds. It's just a great book. While I'm not a meat book expert by any means, this is both an education in all sorts of things. Like, what would you say it's an education in?
I mean, it's an education in butchering, farming, you know, understanding just how meat works in general. It's also got a lot of really great recipes. I don't know. It's a really easy to read, fun book that is, or it's a complete meat education, like, masquerading as a really, like, fun cookbook to read. I think
is really
what it is.
It's a great combination because it's also like a party in your distinctive voice.
Yeah,
hilarious and irreverent at the same time, but full of information.
Yes.
So I think that's great. There are sections, for example, in the book. There's a section called Drinking with the Meat Hook.
That's right.
And then there's a section by Brent Young on how to throw a barbecue.
That's true.
And both of those sections have disclaimers.
Oh, yeah. There's
not
a lot of disclaimers in this book.
Just
just because we're professionals, do not try this at home. I mean, especially the
knives.
Well, I mean, it's not even really the knives. It's mostly the sort of the, you know, idiocy that we find ourselves getting into. You know, the drinking with the meat hook chapters, especially the ice cold dunks, which is sort of an advanced beer shotgunning technique that involves submerging one's head in icy water until you can't feel your head anymore, and then shotgunning a beer, or the bear fights, which are a Jaeger bomb and an Irish car bomb, one after another, and then they sort of fight in your stomach.
Does the Irish car bomb involve coffee?
Bailey's.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's traditional. It's okay. It's Guinness and then a Boilermaker situation with Jameson or another Irish whiskey and Bailey's or some other sort of Irish creamish kind of thing.
Okay. So how psyched are you about this book? What was the coolest part for you?
I mean, I really enjoyed the process of designing it more than the process of writing it. I mean, not that I didn't... I don't know. I have never written a book before. I've written some magazine articles here and there, and you know, but I've never written a book. And the process of, you know, get it when you get the first manuscript back, and it's you know, there's like squiggles of all kinds of different colored pencils everywhere,
and it's all over the
place.
Yeah,
and it's
a little depressing.
It's a little daunting. Yeah, it's you know, that was difficult. But the designing part, I mean, that was really like what I was the most excited about, because we got the chance to actually design it, like myself and our designer who does all of our logos, Mike Fusco. He just happened to have previously been earlier in his life a book packager for the publishing company that we ended up going with, and they, you know, I mean,
they were happy for you to work with them.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, to me, I wouldn't have allowed us to do that. I think they didn't know us well enough then to say no.
Friends.
But you know, me and Mike, you know, and also Michael Harlan Turkle, who's our photographer, and then also our great friend Kate Bonner, who's our amazing illustrator. You know, we all got to like sort of work together and make this as you know, visually, you know, sort of psychedelic as we mm-hmm. possibly could, because I don't know. I just feel like a lot of cookbooks out there, you know, look the same, and I just didn't see a point in doing a cookbook, whether it was about meat or whatever, that was just sort of
run of the mill.
Well, yeah, I just, you know, this might be my only chance at. So we really decided, you know,
so you're
fuck
shooting
it.
For it,
let's do it, you know, and.
Well, one of my questions is, where did that crazy Earth and Stars background come from for the animal part pictures? There, for every animal, you divide up into butchering sections.
Yeah, so
and there's an Earth and Stars behind it.
Yeah, and those are all actually from their high-res images straight from the NASA website. So those are all downloaded from NASA. Those are actual pictures of space. They're not photoshopped together or anything like that. That is literally, the meat is sort of exploding and floating in space. You know,
whose idea was that?
That was mine. Okay. I was sort of brainstorming different ways to make it, because I didn't want to do a lot of actual, like, you know, hands and, you know, pink blobs of meat and knife and cutting board kind of stuff. Because I, you know, ours is not the first sort of like modern butchering book. And I mean, you know, and I felt a little weird about that. First, we really wanted to be like, oh, the first like of the new wave butcher shop people to have a cookbook. But it was really great that we weren't the first, because we got to look at other cookbooks and, you know, and the people that really focus on butchering techniques. You know, it was visually a little of, you know, the same old. Like, it was just like very visually repetitive.
You can't avoid some of it.
No, you can't avoid it at all. But we decided to sort of go. I was trying to think of a way to sort of like show how animals came apart in a way that was where you could just look at it and you could sort of like your mind could just have like this sort of gestalt and it was and also like the idea of like having it like exploding and in space. Actually, the in space part was that idea was actually Judy Prey, my editor. She was like, and they could be in space, and me and Mike Fusco were like, yeah, totally in space. And that's actually where that idea came from. That wasn't even my idea.
I did not immediately get that, looking at the floating sections, that you meant that they were exploding in space.
Well, I mean, it was just showing them, you know, sort of like, you know, before I moved to New York, I really, like, I owned a lot of old cars, and I was really into old car manuals, and a big, you know, thing that, like, old car manuals, you know, used to do back in, like, the 50s and 60s is show, like, an engine or a transmission sort of, like, exploded, so you can see how all the parts, like, came apart
went together.
And what their context was. And
so you were coming from that school of thought.
Yeah, I was very much coming from, you know, I think the most inspirational book for me when it, like, is not actually a cookbook, is actually a book by a guy named John Muir, who is a former naval atomic engineer, who, you know, tuned in, dropped out, and sort of made a new life for himself in this hippie New Mexico situation in the 60s. And he wrote this amazing book called How to Keep Your Volkswagen Alive for the Complete Idiot. And I owned a lot of air-cooled Volkswagens over the years, and that book was the book that like taught me how to become a mechanic. I have no natural mechanical aptitude, and I sort of wanted to apply a little bit of that visual methodology to the book, because, you know, obviously, like, if you're buying a book on butchering, you might not know anything about it. So, of course, like any true artist, you steal from your betters.
Right, right. And it seems like what makes a person a good mechanic might be similar to what makes a person a good butcher.
Oh, I don't believe. I mean, I think that people have natural aptitudes for things, but I think that anyone can do anything. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of how it's explained to them. You know, some people are visual learners. Some people are, you know, like learn by reading things. Some people learn by doing. I try to incorporate like the sort of visual learning and the, incorporate something for people that, you know, learn by reading. And
right.
And also just like making it not a big deal. I really like the conversational tone that that Keeping Your Volkswagen Alive book had. And it wasn't trying to make being a mechanic like some sort of like next level voodoo stuff that no one, very few can obtain, you know. Mm-hmm. And I feel the same way about, butchering. Mm-hmm. I knew less than nothing about butchering when I sort of got drafted into this vocation of mine. Mm-hmm. And so I know that anyone can become, you know.
That's a humble approach.
Yeah.
So
if I can do it, anybody can.
To let the listeners know, the book is a combination of butchering instructions, recipes, lots of stories, especially about Brooklyn restaurants that you've kind of come to know food in, it sounds like.
Yeah. It has a lot of our friends and, you know, old friends and neighbors, both their recipes and like little blurbs about their, you know, little mini chapters about their restaurants, like Roberta's, you know, the place
right.
where
Roberta's where we're recording in, and
yep.
Potlicker, which is a favorite of mine, and
yep.
Roebling Tea House.
Roebling and also Vinegar Hill House. Uh-huh. There's a recipe from them in there.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, how did the format evolve? How did the idea start out?
Well, I mean, it started out actually, you know, when I first started butchering, I was like sort of alone in this weird little refrigerated shack behind the diner on the south side of Brooklyn, like, you know, cutting up meat and prepping stuff, you know, 10, 12 hours a day, 5-6 days a week, and by myself, just me and like a radio. And so like my mind kind of wandered while I was sort of doing these monotonous things. And I started thinking, you know, at that time there was no new butchering books. Like the most useful book I found was like actually a 1943 book put out by the Department of the Navy about butchering. And so there was very little information in print out at that point that I could find anyway. And
well,
so
probably a apprentice kind of.
Yeah, very much so. Like the type of butchering that I was trying to learn to do was, it's a very sort of
taught by people.
Yeah, it's passed on from one person to another. Mm-hmm. The problem was is I only had like 6 weeks of my life to sort of like spend. I learned from Josh Appleson and Aaron Lenz up at Fleischer's in Kingston, and I had a very short time. You know, I was there basically, you know, 7 days a week for, you know, 6 weeks. 12 hours a day, like learning, but that's really just not enough. Mm-hmm. And I had all these questions, and luckily there was YouTube and there was a little bit of information on YouTube, but I really started to sort of fantasize about like what would be the perfect, butchering book.
To learn yourself.
Mm-hmm. And that idea is just like slowly evolved over the years. And by the time, by the time I was in a position where I had like an agent that I was happy with, and she was helping me like put together the proposal, like I had tweaked it a little bit. It stopped being, cause there were at that point, you know, there were books on the actual, like,
more modern butchering.
Well, just on the minutiae of butchering, which would have been really helpful for me, but like I think for the average person, the minutiae can get a little boring. Mm-hmm. So I tried to make, when putting together the book, you know, putting together the book that is in front of you now, I really tried to think of making each recipe sort of have hidden inside of it a butchering technique, so mm-hmm. that you were there was a point to doing it, and it would make it less tedious.
And you explain it usually within the recipe or at the beginning of the recipe, what the point is and what you're doing or what piece you're using.
Right, but ultimately the point is to like make this recipe that you know is beautifully photographed and looks really delicious. Mm-hmm. So you're doing it towards that end instead of like sort of butchering for butchering's sake. And I think that might make it a little bit more useful and more interesting for like the average home cook, though there's a lot of techniques in there for people that are, you know, more advanced or just into the butchering. We're really trying to strike a happy medium between being fun and being informational.
Yeah, I think a lot of different people might want to buy the book for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of books out there that are, you know, on one side of that or the other. I think that we hopefully have done like a really good job of like splitting the difference in a way that isn't giving short shrift to either the informational or the sort of like entertaining, mm-hmm. Fun, you know, eye candy aspect.
Okay, we have to take a break now. It's Diane Stemple and Tom Mylan on Cutting the Curd. We'll be back in a few.
Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, it's Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. I'm sitting here with Tom Mylan, author of the Meat Hook Meat Book. Subtitle, Buy, Butcher, and Cook Your Way to Better Meat. Hi, Tom.
How's it going?
It's pretty good. So do you miss selling cheese at all?
Oh, of course. I mean, I don't know. My wife brings home, cheese from, you know, we're lucky enough to live in a neighborhood that has, you know, two really great cheese shops, Campbell Cheese and Bedford Cheese, and she brings home cheese, here, like every once in a while, and you know, we eat it, and I'm just like, oh my God, I miss this so much, and I don't recognize the cheeses anymore.
Right.
You know, it used to be like
there's a lot of new ones.
Yeah, it used to be a much smaller world, and I feel sort of out of my depth now with cheese, but mm-hmm. I definitely do miss it, and every time I eat a really great piece of cheese, we were in Paris for our sort of second honeymoon, and we went to Marie Quentin, is mm-hmm. that the name of that cheese shop?
Something like that.
Yeah, and just walking in there, just like, wow, just completely blown away, like having, you know, all of those amazing raw milk cheeses and, you know, like mm-hmm. actually going to a cheese shop in France where, like, you can, you know, actually have all these things that we sort of, like, you know, covet and, you know mm-hmm. people sneak into the country here.
That warms my heart to know you miss cheese.
Oh, man, so much.
When you first gravitated toward meat, what were the big differences?
Well, I mean, it's it's not so much that I gravitated towards meat. I just sort of expanded from what I learned from, you know, especially local cheese here in New York. And once I left Murray's and went to work for Andrew Tarlow and Mark Firth at Marlowe and Sons, partially as a manager, but also as a person that would help them source local, not just local cheeses, but local dairy, local eggs
for their store,
for the store, mm-hmm. for the restaurants, mm-hmm. And then, you know, once that was sort of happening, and they saw that, like, the, you know, the quality, because they were really dubious about American cheese,
mm-hmm. But no longer.
No, not at all. No, I mean, like, Andrew's
some
really
of our best supporters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Andrew took a lot of convincing, but you know, I started bringing in some stuff from Mateo, mm-hmm. And you know, Sprout Creek, and you know, Cato Corner, places mm-hmm. like that I had, you know,
sold and
eaten a lot of at Murray's, and that actually was kind of the gateway to them sort of giving me enough rope to sort of hang myself when it came to sourcing meat. And they were like, okay, well, you've really succeeded at this. We need, you know, meat for the hamburger at Diner.
Uh-huh.
And so I was, you know, roaming around. I found...
Aren't they always local meat-centric, though? I mean...
No.
No, they weren't. Oh, okay.
No,
I didn't realize that.
Carolyn Fidanza, who was their chef up until, you know, 2006, 2007, mm-hmm. Because she came from Savoy. She was very, you know, locally mm-hmm. oriented. The problem was it was difficult to get... get places to deliver to Brooklyn, even though it was just right over the bridge. I mean, huh. we couldn't get the, you know, the local produce, Guy Jones and people like that. And to the point in which they actually rented a refrigeration truck and were driving it up to Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, to buy produce once a week for Diner and Marlowe and Sons. Mm-hmm. At a certain point when there was absolutely no distribution.
Wow.
And
that must be very different now.
Oh, yeah, incredibly different.
I mean, delivering to Brooklyn is a wild idea.
Yeah, it's a completely different world now. But
are they scared of Brooklyn?
I don't know. I mean, it was just like, you know, I think what it was is there just weren't that many restaurants that were uh-huh. interested, uh-huh. That were willing to, like, pay the price point and, like, uh-huh. deal with, like, seasonality and the fact that it might, like, be dirty or have some bugs on it or right. something like that. But, you know, they sort of started with the produce and then, you know, wanted me to help with the meat, and I, you know, sort of found Josh and Jessica, who at the time had opened Fleischer's up in Kingston just a couple years before, and we started buying ground beef, and then we started buying some other things, and at a certain point, you know, Josh was like, look, we can't sell you any, like, we can't do this anymore. We've run the numbers and we're losing money selling you guys ground beef and already cut up, you know, portion steaks and whatever. He's like, I'm happy to sell you meat, but I can only sell you at hanging weight. So half steers, whole.
So someone
pigs.
Has to learn to cut it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, that was you.
Yeah. So they were like, okay.
Did you step up? Were you happy to volunteer?
Well, I mean, the thing of it is like butchering was not a cool thing then, you know, mm-hmm. like, and so no one wanted to become the butcher,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, nobody wanted to go upstate and be trained and whatever. So I was kind of stuck. If this program was going to work, there mm-hmm. needed to be somebody to butcher. And I was the only person that like had any desire to do it. So, mm-hmm. I, you know, basically like,
so you fell into it.
I literally fell into it. I, you know, was basically like, you know, I took a huge pay cut and I moved upstate uh-huh. and lived with Josh and Jessica for, you know, 6 weeks and learned how to mm-hmm. cut. And then next thing I know is in this little tin shack, you know, mm-hmm. refrigerated tin shack behind the diner, with like, you know, a whole steer and, you know, three pigs and a couple whole lambs like rolling in every week. And then figuring out with the chefs at Diner and Marlowe, like, what to do with all these different parts.
Right.
Because before that...
Oh, because you had the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you know, you have to... And I don't know. I think that kind of informs the book. That trial and error with the chefs really informs the book. It's mm-hmm. it's not coming from theory. It's not coming from some book I read. It's literally stuff that we did trial and error that went out on the floor and like people ate it and either said like this sucks or this is amazing, you know, every single night. And it was this continuous like, what are we gonna do all these fucking beef shanks? What are we gonna do with this
right,
thing? What are we
right.
you know? Because you
so there's a learning curve for both you and the chefs together.
Yeah, no, it was very much we were in it together. Like me and Sean and, and Dave and Carolyn were like really in it together, and we had to like invent ways to like cook every single part of it. What do you do with a fucking pig head? What do you do with like a beef shank? You know, what do you do with like pig feet? You know, because you can't just throw it out.
Right.
You know, you pay, you know, it costs the same whether it's a foot or a shank or a or a beef heart or whatever.
Right.
It all costs the same amount of money per pound.
So you have to get as much as you can out of it.
Yeah, you can't. Well, I mean, you can't throw it away.
So you learned nose to tail before it was cool.
Well, I mean, I think nose to tail was cool. I mean, Fergus Henderson, thank you so much for writing that nice blurb on the front. I mean, Fergus Henderson went a long way towards making that cool with his nose to tail book. That had come out a couple years before this whole thing transpired, but there were not that many people actually practicing it in New York or in the United States as far as I know at that at that time. And you know, we learned the only way that you can really learn anything and truly know it, like complete trial and error, and just coming up with some theories and trying to do some research and then applying it and seeing how it comes out and see how like people who are expecting a real high level of
taste
and and you know texture and quality and flavor see how they respond to it and, and that was really you know that I think that process really lies at the heart of this
the book. And the beginning
a lot of
the
success
book,
and a lot of failure.
You name some pieces of meat, secreto, oyster steak, the pear. I've never heard of them, and I've never really seen them at the meat hook.
Oh, the secreto is usually there.
Oh, okay. Is it in the case, or do you have to ask for it?
It's in the pork case.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, what we put in the case is very seasonal.
Okay.
So during the summertime, you'll see like a cut like the pear or the oysters. I mean, the oyster steak's always in the case.
Okay.
The problem is there's not that many per animal. A lot of these cuts that are like weird cuts, there's only maybe like enough to feed two people on an entire steer, and we're only bringing in 3 to 5 steers a week. So, you know, that's like 10 steaks.
Will you have your customers who love those pieces, who you save them for, or, you know, are people pear fanatics?
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, we have three or four people that are really, you know, into like the oyster steak or really into this cut. And, or, you know, we have a lot of people that are really into beef heart, which
surprises
is actually
you.
It's one of those things where like people think of it as offal, and what it really is, if you treat it properly and marinate it, it's actually a really amazing steak. It's not like liver or kidneys or something like that has that kind of organy, gross flavor. But we have people that, you know, we have standing orders every week. Like, you know, we have a guy that comes in for all the beef kidneys, a guy that comes in for the beef heart, a guy that, you know.
Restaurants or regular people?
Regular people.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
We don't do a whole lot of restaurant stuff.
Okay.
You know, because that was kind of the thing when we left Marlowe and Daughters. We really wanted – Marlowe and Daughters was very – restaurant centric. It was really like about giving the restaurants what they wanted, Diner Marlowe, and really sort of like leaving the customer with kind of like whatever they didn't want, which was a little difficult.
Okay. So your mission was different.
Yeah, our mission
from
was
the start.
Our mission was to be customers first, and you know, you know, any restaurants that we might sell to, very much secondary.
Okay, okay. Now, in the world of food, I was expecting we'd have more time to talk about this. Things are getting more and more political. What do you see as the most important issues in meat or in your realm?
I mean, I think the single most important thing is that. I mean, I think you have people like Michael Pollan and others who are really like calling to the fore the sort of lack of initiative on the part of, you know, the government or the whatever. Obviously, the governmental system and the big corporation system is completely like broken. And I and, you know, the sort of like raison d'etre of the meat hook and, you know, all of the little weird restaurant scene and everything that's going on. That I think really is making a significant difference in the United States. Those are all systems that are like not trying to like fight that Goliath, and instead just like walking away and deciding to do something,
being a smaller system on the side for
exactly,
a certain amount of people.
Yeah, seeking the alternative, and you know, it's interesting. You see now you see more progressive supermarkets like Whole Foods. You know, they're starting to move towards like pasture raised animals and grass fed beef, mm-hmm. Whereas
or at least marking it. You know, noting which is which.
Exactly. But they definitely, you know, see that as a growth potential. And I think that, like, it's our job as, you know, purveyors of meat, and it's and the job of the people that are consuming it who care about that to, like, support that alternate system. Because that alternate system is going to lead the industry away from its like, not like undesirable practices, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the most important thing. I think you can beat your head against the wall about, you know, politics, and I just don't see, like, you know, writing letters and you know, yelling at people as like really it's just not productive. I think it's really frustrating, and I think it burns a lot of people out.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't see that as productive. I think it's much more productive to imagine the world that you want to live in and make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, you'll show that world to more people, and more people will agree with you and join that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know.
At the Meat Hook, you've really established a new world.
Oh, absolutely.
For your customers and
well, it's not just the Meat Hook. It's
the neighborhood.
We have a new sandwich shop opening up. We have a restaurant that's seasonal that's out in the Rockaways called Rippers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not just like the butcher shop where you come and like buy your like sort of Michael Pollan approved like 100% grass fed ribeye or something. You can also like go and get like a burger at the beach, or you can get like a hoagie.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's you know, and that's kind of like in a, you know, our philosophy in a nutshell, whether it's the book or the shop or the restaurants, is it like, you know, good food should be fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like this sort of like self-flagellant, you know,
right,
sort of like pain and misery, liberal guilt thing. I don't think, you know, it's you know, the bees with honey, that kind of thing. Like it's much better to put forward a fun and desirable way of being.
Offering.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever suspect in your early 20s you would be running a business?
I never thought I'd write a book. I never thought that I'd be a butcher. I never thought I'd be a small business owner. I never thought I'd live in New York.
Were you an English major?
I was an English major, and then I was really broke, and so I worked full time. I actually worked for Whole Foods. I worked for Whole Foods like 5 days a week, and then I squeezed in all my schooling around that, and so I didn't have a lot of time to actually write. But one of the things that my girlfriend at the time was an art major, and I found art much more fun because I could do whatever I wanted,
uh-huh,
you know, because I guess I'm like, I have like a sort of I have a sort of like anarchist streak. And I could do it whenever time I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can do pretty, actually, I think you do better art at 3 o'clock in the morning than you do at like noon. And mm-hmm, that was the thing that really appealed to me. I was like, all right, I'm going to shit can all this, like, writing the great American novel, and I'm going to, like, do abstract painting and, you know, performance art, because
mm-hmm,
it was just a lot easier to do with, like, no sleep and maybe, uh-huh, you know, slightly, like, half-crocked.
Did you write this book at 3 in the morning?
I wrote this at 3 in the morning. I wrote it at 3 in the afternoon. I wrote it, like,
whenever you could.
Whenever I could. I squeezed it in. Actually, almost this entire book was written in the backyard of my friend Alicia's bar, Tuffet.
I saw that just today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On Graham Avenue.
Uh-huh.
That's
great.
Wi-Fi and stuff. Beautiful backyard.
Well, the writing and the voice of the book is part of the pleasure, and it's delightful
I'm
to
glad you like it.
See you again and talk about the Meat Hook meat book.
Good to see you.
Goodbye to Tom Mylan. This is Cutting the Curd, Diane Stemple. I'll be back in a month with another book.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.